Okay, still people looking for a seat. You have to get here early. Most people camp out on a Thursday night to get the best seats. That may be a bit of an exaggeration. Okay, getting some people to get a nice place. Especially if you want a chair, that's really hard to get. So, for today's talk, this afternoon after lunch, if you ever go to Bodhinyana Monastery after lunch, it's free counseling sessions. I always say there's no such thing as a free lunch. Maybe a big food to me. I still have to work afterwards. Sometimes I thought I'd retire one day, but someone reminded me, look, I'm still, this is just over 63 now, but I already get Meals on Wheels. You bring the food to me in your car every day. That's Meals on Wheels. But anyway, so one person again was talking to me about in a relationship, people always arguing. And how we can stop people arguing, husbands and wives, partners. And let's get even further, how we can stop our politicians arguing. And how we can stop people of religion arguing. And that's really serious business, because okay, in a family you don't do too much harm, maybe. But when people of religion argue, we start wars and we destroy this planet. But you can see today, we have two Mahayana monks here. And three Theravada monks. We always make sure we outnumber the Mahayana. But these are friends, these are mates. You know, Vedalgaksan spent a long time in our monastery and they've been hanging out at Bodhinyana with us for the last few days. When I go to Korea, I usually stay with Vedalgaksan. And you know that there's a great sense of peace and harmony between us. We don't tend to argue. We try to find common ground instead of having these terrible arguments. But sometimes I wanted to find out, why is it that people argue? If we could only find out why people argue, then maybe we can find solutions for it. And because they came up to me, I've given them advice before. You know, I said it here a few weeks ago, the calendar method. Remember the calendar method? If you have an argument in your family, husband and wife, and you want to find out who's right, it's endless arguing with one another, who's right and who's wrong. It doesn't matter even if you're the greatest philosopher and debater in the whole world, you will still not be able to convince your wife that you are right. And vice versa. So it's endless and a total waste of time trying to convince someone else that you're right and they're wrong. And so I said the calendar method, very easy. Odd day of the month, 1st, 3rd, 5th, 7th, 9th, 11th. Odd day of the month, she's right. Even day of the month, he's right. And it's such an obvious solution because that means you're right fair, fair. Same amount of days every year. And it means straight away you solve the problem. So what day is it today? So the girls are right today. You think that's good? Wait till tomorrow. But apparently that people still sort of didn't accept this. So they asked me, can you please deeper, because this is not working. So, you know, why is it, first of all, that people always have to be right? And that's one of the interesting things to understand, that, you know, you're conditioned from the time that you were at school to think that the person who's right is the one who's better, superior, the best. Which is one of the reasons why the people say, now why is it that he always has to be right? No, males always have to be right. Why is it that girls always have to be right? What are you talking about there? It's all about trying to be the best, superior, not to be inferior. And this is where we learn from our school. If you get the answer right, you get a prize. Your ego gets massaged. You think you are something. You're getting on in this world because you get the questions right. And that starts to condition us, brainwash us, to think if we get something wrong, that we are an idiot, we're hopeless, we're worthless, we're not useful at all, that we're inferior beings if we are wrong. And because of that, that people try and make themselves right, even they know they're wrong, they will not admit it, because that is like admitting that they're inferior. And this is one of the problems here, because people have egos, because they are so concerned about being judged by others, that other people's opinions of them are more important than anything else in the world, which is why people always have to be right. Why a prime minister always has to be right, because to admit he's wrong is somehow that he's inferior, he doesn't deserve, you know, to run the country. And unfortunately, we all know that prime ministers do make mistakes. They are wrong. But how many times has a prime minister admitted they were wrong? And what do you do with them if they do admit they're wrong? You throw them out. Wouldn't it be wonderful if our leaders would say, yes, I was wrong. And you clap them and applaud them, said, wonderful. You are a human being. You make mistakes like all of us make mistakes. Thank you for being honest. It's the fear of making mistakes and the fear of this idea of inferiority which makes us hold on to our opinions and beliefs even though we know that they are wrong. Because the last thing we ever want to admit to is, I was wrong. It's ego again. So what do we do to overcome that in a, say, relationship, in a marriage? I think that when we have these marriage vows, we should say in the vows to our partner, our loved one, I'm going to share my life with you. I am going to be wrong many times. And I admit that from the very beginning. And I won't always be right. And your partner says the same thing. Yes. So you set the groundwork, the rules from the very, very beginning. It's all right to be wrong. It's okay to make mistakes. I don't always have to be right. Oh, what a relief. There's a lot of freedom in life when you allow yourself to make mistakes, when you allow yourself to do stupid things, when you allow yourself to say bad jokes. And here is the bad joke for today. This is courtesy, they're not here today, Barbara and Ainsley, who sent me a very nice joke when I was on retreat. And that was about the man who was in the cinema. And in the aisle right in front of him, there was a dog watching the movie. And this dog was amazing. Every time it was an exciting part of the movie, you could see the dog's hair stand up. He was so afraid when it was a terrible crisis. And when there was a sad part of the movie, the dog could see tears coming from the dog's eyes. It was crying. And when there was a funny part, the dog was laughing his head off. And it was amazing. And at the end of the movie, the person sitting behind had to go and ask the owner of this dog, that's the most amazing thing I've seen, that's incredible. I saw your dog really enjoying that movie. Yeah, it is incredible, said the owner, because he hated the book. Okay, there we go. I tried that out a few people beforehand just to test one, but it worked. So I can make mistakes and say stupid things sometimes like bad jokes. But you can see I've got that confidence. I don't mind making mistakes. I don't have to be right. I don't have to have approval from other people. Which is why that you don't have to get into so many arguments. So once you see that all arguments is not having to be right, you don't have to be right. In fact, it's much more fun being wrong. I tell this to kids. When you go to school and you go through university and you go through all these exams, haven't you figured it out, kids, young people, that you'll have to do another exam next year if you pass the one this year? So just get out as soon as you can, fail the exam, and then you're free. Do it wrong. And any of your parents say, Ajahn Brahm, I'm trying to get my kid to have a good education. Yeah. Einstein, he didn't finish university. Michael Dell, he dropped out. Stephen Jobs, drop out. All the best. Billionaires. These are the people who realize there's something else in life than academic intelligence. It's emotional intelligence. The ability to be at peace with themselves. The ability just to understand themselves and their emotions and not having to be right all the time. And so what happens is, instead of arguing with each other, we realize there's something much more important than arguing with each other. Harmony, love, peace. Because no one is right when you argue. My master Ajahn Chah used to say this. When people were arguing and they wanted him to be the judge to say who was right and who was wrong, and had this married couple come up, and he would look at one of them and said, you're right, but not correct. And the other one, you're correct, but not right. That's a beautiful way of saying things. Yeah, in your own mind you've got it right, but you've lost the bigger picture. You know, you're destroying the relationship over the most stupid of things. And it really is amazing what people argue over. Do you remember that Gulliver's Travels, Jonathan Swift book a long time ago? I read this as a kid because it was required reading. And this was a war between the Lilliputians and something else. I don't know who the other ones were. And you know what the war was about? On which side of an egg, a boiled egg, you should crack when you eat it. No, the sharp end or the blunt end. And that was just a wonderful satire on the governments of the day, going to wars for stupid things. You know, like, who's got the right God? And somebody asked me earlier, because there's a few people who come here, you know, on rehab courses, and they were asking me about the 12 steps, you know, the Alcoholics Anonymous started. Now, people with addictions, and they said, you've got to believe in a supreme being. That's one of the steps. So, as a Buddhist, what should I do? Because I don't really believe in some guy in a grey beard up in the sky somewhere. But what can I do? What's the Buddhist idea of that supreme being? And this is when I introduced a little story of how we can stop arguing with each other in religions. And I love this little story because it's a good way of understanding how we can cross barriers and understand one another by having a deeper truth rather than just arguing on this stupid superficial level. And that was when I was giving a presentation. It was a chaplaincy conference in UWA many years ago. And like many of these conferences, I like the conferences when I'm not just speaking alone, when you're debating with somebody, or you're having a co-presentation so you can chat with each other afterwards. And my co-presenter was the old Abbot Placid, the former abbot of the monastery up in Eunorcia. Now, we were really good friends. And I say we're good friends, and so much so that when he died a few years ago, I was the only non-Catholic, non-Christian even, invited to his funeral mass. I don't not only went there, I gave a little speech up the top there. Because, you know, all the other monks in Eunorcia know that we were very close friends. And it was wonderful that, you know, I could, you know, get into a Catholic mass as a Buddhist monk. And that's lovely that can happen. So anyway, at this conference, in the audience was a fellow called Father Frank Brennan, who's a very well-known Australian. He was the intellectual, academic professor or something or other as well, who was selected by the Australian government to lead a committee to draft a human rights charter for the Australian Constitution. So this was not a lightweight. This was a very deep thinking man. And when he stood up and asked me, Ajahn Brahm, what is the Buddhist concept of God? And I realized you have to give, you know, a reasonable answer to such a high intellectual. And so, this is how I answered him. And I'm very happy with this answer. It's as an example how we can stop arguments in the big field of religion. So I turned to my co-presenter, Abbot Placid, and I said, this friend of mine I've known for many years, the abbot of the Benedictine monastery up in New Norcia. Ever since I met him, he's been banging on about everybody is searching for God. He said that's one of his core beliefs. And I say, here's my friend. I respect his beliefs. This is how much I respect them. If everyone is searching for God, and I ask, what am I searching for, Ajahn Brahm? What are you people in front of me searching for? What are Buddhists throughout the whole world searching for? What are atheists searching for? And I said that most of you are searching for some peace in your life, some respect. I say respect because if you have some disability, now maybe sort of physical disability, mental disability, any sort of problems, addictions from the past, sometimes that is stigmatized, you don't get respect. And that is a terrible, terrible thing. You search for respect from others and to respect yourself, the ability to love another person and also to be loved. You're searching for truth in life, for meaning. You're searching for peace. So I said, if that's what I'm searching for and all the other Buddhists are searching for, and this guy next to me say everyone is searching for God, then that must be what God means. And straight away you got a very deeper understanding of the concept of a higher reality. And at the same time, you had harmony between great faiths by saying this is what we are believing in. And isn't that something which is far easier for people to grasp, understand, get their head around than again some person in the sky which no one can really describe or some theological concept which is just too hard for ordinary people to understand. This is something real, true, and something you can recognize. So straight away you found a common bond between us. So there's no more arguments after that. That is how we solve arguments. It was putting two things together. My understanding of Buddhism, my friend's understanding of Christianity, putting them together and getting something bigger than both of us. And this is why arguments don't work. They are confrontational instead of cooperational. So if there ever is an argument, instead of saying who's right and who's wrong, I remember my master, Ajahn Chah. You're correct, but not right. You're right, but not correct. In other words, you've only got the half-truth, and the other person's only got the half-truth. We sometimes need to put it all together. Listen to each other, first of all. Don't say you're wrong, and I'm right. Listen, that is their perspective. That is valid. Whatever your wife says, you know, she really feels that that's the right thing. Whatever your husband says, he really thinks that that is the right thing. It's not that one is right, one is wrong. It is just that these are two different perspectives. And if we can only join those two perspectives together, we'll come far closer to the truth, like I did with Abbot Placid. And the classic Buddhist tale was the elephant and the seven blind men. You've all heard that before. So, you always like to change things, make them more interesting. And anyway, this is Australia. We don't have elephants. We have kangaroos. So once there were seven blind Australians from birth, and they'd always heard of a kangaroo, a kangaroo. They'd never ever seen a kangaroo ever before. So they decided each to go and find a kangaroo. And the only way they could know a kangaroo was to feel it. So they all went out and felt a kangaroo, and then they came back together, and they compared notes. And one of them, who felt the tail, just like the elephant, said, well, imagine, if you're blind and feel a kangaroo tail, it feels like a snake. So he said it was a snake. A kangaroo is a species of Australian snake, and I was really lucky not to get bitten and killed. I really risked my life for the sake of knowledge. And the guy who felt the legs said, no, that's not snake, they're too hard. They're two furry boomerangs. Because they're right angle things. They're furry boomerangs, that's what a kangaroo is. And the guy who felt the body said, no way, it's not furry boomerangs. It's a furry bag of potatoes. No, it's not, said the one who felt the pouch. It is a Louis Vuitton handbag. Can't be, said the one who felt the joey in the pouch. It's a teddy bear. It can't be a teddy bear, said the one who felt the hands. These are, you see these, the kangaroo paws. It's a flower which goes in the forest. You can see them in King's Park. We have them in Bodhinyana Monastery. They're little flowers. And the one who felt the head, it's not a flower. It is a lampshade on its side. And I was thinking about it. That's very hard to find something for a furry lampshade on its side. No, it's not, said the one who felt the ears. It's these radio antenna, because, you know, kangaroo ears, it goes this way and that way. And anyway, they all argued what a kangaroo was. And of course, they fought about it. And of course, they all had their own aspect of reality. But imagine those seven blind men had, instead of arguing, combined their views. And then they would have come across a kangaroo is a sack of potatoes on two furry boomerangs. With a snake on a furry snake on the back. And it's got a Louis Vuitton handbag halfway up in which they keep a teddy bear. Two flowers in the front and lampshade on its side, conical lampshade on the side with two little radar things on the top. That's a pretty good description of a kangaroo for someone who's never seen one before. Now, back to the elephant. I don't know if you heard this one. Once there were seven blind elephants. And they'd heard the story from the sutras before. Because that's actually in the Buddha sutras. Buddha invented the seven blind men and the elephant. Once there were seven blind elephants. And they'd always wondered about man, human being. What's a man? So they read this story. They heard this story because they can't read. They were elephants. No, blind anyway. They were blind. Anyway, so they heard man. So they decided the only way to find out what a man was is each go off into the village or towns and go and feel an elephant. So feel a man. There were elephants. Go and feel a man. And once we feel a man, just like in the story, then we can all come back together. We can combine notes. But you know the elephants, they didn't argue. They all agreed. They all had the same experience. A man is flat. That's the only way an elephant can feel a man. Anyway, with arguments, wouldn't it be wonderful if we can combine our knowledge? Instead of thinking that I have the whole truth, nothing but the truth, and only the truth, then we don't have arguments. Not only do we have greater harmony and peace in our life, but actually, wisdom, understanding, knowledge gets advanced. We see far further and deeper. When we don't argue with one another, we combine our understanding, combine our views of life. These are Mahayana monks. I'm a Theravada monk. We actually come from totally different traditions. But we can be the best of friends, and whenever I go to these places, I learn so much from all the different traditions. And learning from the different traditions is amazing. It's wonderful. I give so many talks. I think the last time, I don't think I've given this little simile. This actually came from Sister Hui Khan, just around the corner in Victoria Park. And she told how we can combine traditions because she had a disciple who had a mother-in-law who was causing her great strife. And this particular girl, she was Vietnamese refugee, married an Australian man. And they had a very good relationship together, the Vietnamese girl, the Australian man. The problem was the Vietnamese girl's mother-in-law, this Australian girl, who didn't want her son, to marry an Asian. And so this poor Vietnamese girl was trying her hardest, you know, to create a good relationship with her mother-in-law. But no matter what she did, how she spoke, how she behaved, the mother-in-law just did not like her. So what did she do? She went to the temple for some advice. And they gave her all the advice of loving kindness, speaking kind words, saying, doing kind things. It didn't work. So she went to the temple again. And they taught her chanting. Do some chanting. And they did chanting. And again, it didn't work. So let's get to the real solid stuff. Meditation. Loving kindness meditation. Where you make your mind so strong with loving kindness. And you blast people with love. So she blasted her mother-in-law with this beautiful love. It didn't work. And this poor girl was just really, really getting to her wit's end. You know, she had this beautiful relationship with her husband, but the one with her husband's mother was just terrible. And apparently she was in the temple one day, praying, meditating, trying whatever she was, but she was so stressed out and tired, she fell asleep. And that's when she had a vision. She had a vision of the Mahayana goddess of mercy, Kuan Yin. Kuan Yin. But with a difference. You may be seeing the goddess of mercy, Kuan Yin. This image in Mahayana Buddhism. Just know with this really tall standing person with this draped cloth over the head and holding sort of a bottle of kindness. Beautiful features. And very elegant statue. It's one of the really beautiful sculptures you can find in Buddhist iconography. But this was a Kuan Yin with a difference. Everything else was just as they had in the statues in the temple, except the face. Because the face was the face of her mother-in-law. Everything else was like Kuan Yin, but the face of her mother-in-law. So when she came out of her dream or whatever it was, she remembered that. And she said, this is a sign. So from that day on, whenever she saw her mother-in-law, she imagined her mother-in-law. And around it, the figure of Kuan Yin. And so her whole attitude changed towards her mother-in-law. She saw her as a symbol of kindness. Now, those of you who are Theravada, who don't like Kuan Yin for one reason or another, don't worry. If you see your, say, father-in-law, imagine him just like the big Buddha behind me, but with your father-in-law's face. Because what it does, it changes perceptions. Different way of looking at things. Now that is the powerful way. Using wisdom power to change relationships with people. And that's a very beautiful, effective way. So if you are having arguments with your wife, with your husband, try that. Imagine your husband the next time. Imagine he's got a little bump on his head, long earlobes, and he's just like the Buddha. How can you argue with a Buddha? They're so wise. Your wife, imagine her long hair just like the long hair of Kuan Yin, the goddess of mercy. Sweet and giving so much kindness to the world. Change your attitude, the way you look. Add a few positive perceptions. And it's amazing how that changes the whole ball game. And then you find you can live in peace and harmony with someone. I'm really, really trying hard to get Judy Bishop to look at Bill Shorten as with the face of the Buddha, and for Bill Shorten to look at Judy Bishop like Kuan Yin. Those are politicians in Australia, by the way, for those overseas. Wouldn't that be a wonderful way of getting something done in the parliament instead of always people arguing with one another? But when it's, I always say, why is it that people argue? Why is it they have to be right? Why do you want to be right? And again, it's just this terrible, terrible pride that to admit you're wrong is something you just find very, very difficult. Why? If you are practicing something like Buddhism, like Dharma, it's wonderful, you don't have to be right. You can be wrong. And in fact, you are admired much more if you do admit your mistakes and say that you've done something terrible or you've done something wrong, that you weren't right. I'm sorry, I misunderstood, I made a mistake. You are admired more because you're admitting the reality of being a human being. No one ever is perfect. We all make mistakes. And sometimes I'm going to be controversial here. Did the Buddha ever make mistakes? We always want our leaders to be perfect. But look, he just ordained his cousin, Devadatta, who tried to kill him. He should have known better than that. Maybe. That's controversial. But did the Buddha make mistakes? I know Ajahn Chah, he made mistakes. My teacher, my great master. You know, sometimes people don't like to admit the mistakes your great teacher made. But you know, one of the big mistakes he made, I was telling this to one of the visitors, many, many years ago, and I was a young monk there, we had this a visit from the wife of the American ambassador. Now, this was in the 70s, okay? This was almost like a visit from the wife of God in Thailand, from the American ambassador. Because they had so much power in the country. They just, you know, won that Vietnam War. Well, they lost it, actually. But they were still very powerful. And anyway, when she came up, Ajahn Chah totally got it wrong. Because she just wanted to come up to do some meditation and have a nice peaceful time to see a wise person. And what did Ajahn Chah do? He had this big ceremony for her. Had all the monks to come, sitting in line, and just having speeches and just saying how wonderful it was that she would come up here. She got all of that in Bangkok every day. She wanted to get away from that and she went to this forest monastery and got exactly the same. She left and never came back again. Ajahn Chah blew it. Honestly, he did. And I've blown it many times in my life, made big mistakes. Well, I've told you most of the mistakes I made. Many of them. Oh, what's one of the... Oh, yeah. My favourite mistake I like telling people is, you know, when I did that chanting some years ago. Chanting. It was a marriage service. I do many marriage services. Be careful because I was tired. I do work very hard and sometimes. And when you're tired, your brain doesn't work as well as it should do. And so I did the wrong chanting. I did the funeral chant. And once you get started, you can't stop. And I just carried on. I did the whole funeral chant for this happy couple. And they didn't understand it. They was going smiling. Oh, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Wonderful chanting. Because in Pali, they don't understand. So, you know, check up on your monks, you know, Sri Lankan monks, Burmese monks, Korean monks, they probably do the chanting. You don't know what you're chanting. And sometimes we do get it wrong. And you know, the amazing thing is, incredible thing is, those couple are still happily married. They got a few. So, yeah, I make mistakes and do stupid things. But I tell everybody. Now, you know, I just made you laugh by telling my stupid mistake. And I made him snort on camera. That's going all the way through South Korea. You're not afraid of making mistakes. In fact, it makes you human. If Ajahn Chah never made a mistake, if he didn't do wrong things, he would not be so admirable and inspiring. If I was perfect, never made mistakes, not so many people come here to listen to me. You're a human being. You make mistakes. The only difference is we all make mistakes. I admit them. And I share them. And I make you laugh. So next time you make a mistake, please come and tell me. And I'll share it. to make everybody laugh. Because what are we laughing at? We're laughing. We're human beings. We make mistakes. Welcome to life. You don't have to be perfect. So I don't have to be right. I can be wrong. I can make mistakes. Because sometimes if you always think you're right, how on earth can you learn? How on earth can you grow when you think you're so perfect? There's no more room in your spiritual life to learn any more, to grow any more, to reach for any more, because you're already perfect. Do you want to be like that? If you are, you are dead. Spiritually a corpse, if you think you're right. And it's wonderful, you don't have to be right, which is brilliant. So, that when you're having an argument with someone, say, look, why are you arguing? You don't have to be right. So tell that to your partner next time there's an argument. You don't have to be right, darling. Well, so, give it a try, you might get... What do you mean by that? So when you don't have to be right, it's okay to make mistakes. It means we don't have to sort of stand up for what we believe in when we're not really quite sure whether what we believe in is right or wrong. And too many times we've made those mistakes in the past, we should learn from them. And always, just to whatever our opinions are, whatever we think is true, whatever we actually believe right now, please, always give yourself a bit of doubt that maybe I haven't seen the full picture. Maybe I've only just seen a part of the elephant. Maybe I can actually learn from others, learn from my partner, learn from other people, you know, actually to see more about the truth of life. And anyway, you know what happens? All these arguments are just about stupid, superficial things. And all the arguments, again, come from a sense of ego, and always come from your thinking. People who are calm and peaceful, they don't tend to argue. It's only when you think that you argue. And you think, and the argument gets worse, and more and more think, and it gets worse. It'd be wonderful if people could learn how to restrain their thinking. And then instead of thinking, we can see. There's a little book somewhere around called The Wisdom Born of Silence. I always wanted to have people understand that it's only when you're silent can you trust your wisdom. All wisdom comes from silence. You want us to understand how that works, not from thoughts. It is a simile of the lake in the mountains. I usually give this simile during meditation retreats. A lake in the mountains, if it has any waves on the surface or any ripples, you will never see a true reflection of the moon and the stars at night. The reflection will be distorted because of the waves and the ripples on the surface of the lake. You can't even see into the surface of the lake to see what fish are there swimming, because the whole thing is being agitated. But if you can manage to get into the mountains on a still night and go and see a lake which is perfectly still, without a ripple on the surface, then that lake becomes like a glass mirror. It perfectly reflects the moon and the stars in the heavens above, and all of the forests surrounding. Only when your mind is still can you have a perfect reflection of the truth. When it's thinking, when it's agitated, everything gets distorted. You can't see the real picture. That is why people argue. They're too agitated, and they can't see the true picture. If you were even standing and bending over that lake, if it is waves you can't see underneath, but again, when it is still, perfectly still, you look straight down and you can see all the fish and other little animals are living in that water. In fact, only when it's perfectly still, when all the mud settles to the bottom, can you actually see right down to the bottom, to see the gravel, the stones, maybe the plants in the bottom of the lake when it's perfectly still. That was the Buddha's simile for wisdom, for insight. Only when the lake is perfectly still can you see right through the lake to the very, very bottom of things. Only then can you have wisdom, truth, Which is one of the reasons why, if people do meditate, if you have stillness, you don't tend to argue so much. It's one of the reasons why we have retreats. One of the reasons why people send their wives on the retreat. Or send their husbands. And their husbands come back new, improved models. Otherwise, you're going to ask for your money back. More peaceful, more still, more wise, less argumentative. And it's obvious to me why that happens. The more stressed you are, the more rushing around you are, the more agitated you are, the more you will argue. So that's one of the other ways to overcome arguments. Learn how to relax a little bit. To calm the mind, to become more still. And then you have wisdom. You get a pure, clear reflection of things. And so you don't go arguing over stupid things. Wisdom means you see better priorities. Being right is not the priority. Because everyone thinks they're right when they're wrong. They're right but not correct. They're correct but not right. And it just causes more problems. Instead, even if you do have a difference of opinion, sometimes it's best to keep quiet. There's an old Zen story, which I adapted. Always, all these stories, always change them, because they're supposed to grow. Life is not supposed to be dead, it's supposed to adapt, evolve, and change, and go deeper and more interesting. And that was the story of the flag in the wind. And remember that story, many of you may have read this in old Zen books, a flag in the wind, and one of the monks said, you see that flag moving? And the second monk said, it's not the flag which is moving, it's the wind which is moving. And had an argument, what's moving, the wind or the flag? So they went to see the Zen master, and the Zen master said, you're both wrong, it is your mind is moving. And they still argued, so the three of them, the Zen master and his two monks, they went to see the Theravada, Forest Ajahn. And he said it was a flag moving. This monk said, and then he said, I said it's not the flag moving, it's the wind moving. And the Zen master said, no, the mind was moving. And the forest monk, he solved the answer, the problem. He said, it wasn't the flag moving, it wasn't the wind moving, it wasn't the mind moving, your mouths were moving. That's the problem in a marriage. Zip, okay, shut your mouth. And then there would be no divorces. It's absolutely true. I don't know where they are these days, but some years ago, you know, because, you know, I speak Thai, trained in Thai, we've got many Thai people coming here. There was this couple. Amazing couple. Because she was Thai. She could only speak Thai. She couldn't speak a word of English. Absolutely not a word of English. The Australian guy spoke English, obviously. He couldn't speak a word of Thai. And they've been happily married for years. Honestly, no arguments. Had such fun together and just beautiful relationship. So that's why I really think interracial marriages are really good. But for goodness sake, don't learn your partner's language. Instead, let's learn the language of love and kindness and peace and happiness and harmony. Learn that language. And then you'll have a very happy time. And I was going to finish off because somebody, they always ask me these questions on the internet. And the last question about, you know, arguments and harmony was interreligious marriages. Because, you know, they are an interreligious marriage somewhere in the world, I forget where, and they sent an email, can you please talk about this? I'm just going to just spend a few moments on this. Interreligious, what the heck is wrong with interreligious marriages? And I'm very proud of a disciple I have got in Singapore. She is a Buddhist, and she's married to a Muslim. And they have two children. Honest, one is a Christian, the other one's a Hindu. And I've been begging them for years, please have one more, make it a Jew, and then we've got the whole spread. Isn't that wonderful that they can actually do that? There's four people in the marriage, the husband, wife, and two kids, four different religions, and they live together in peace and harmony. Because what that does, it shows it can be done. How do they do that? They go to the heart of their faith and religions. Like I said, how I could have a deeper understanding between a Catholic abbot, a Benedictine abbot, and a Buddhist abbot, with the idea of like a god. Get a bit deeper. Compassion, kindness, wisdom, love. Look, quite frankly, no one has a patent on wisdom and compassion and love. No one has that. It's free for everybody. And, you know, I can't sort of, you don't have to pay a commission on any kindness you take away from here. Any wisdom you learn is given for free because no one owns it. It's there to be taken. It's just like the air you breathe. You know, we managed to actually give people the idea that you have to own land, pass it off. You get deeds for land. And sometimes that people are beginning to own water, and your rights to water. Hopefully they never ever start to partition off air. And to breathe the air in this temple, you have to pay a fee. And they bottle air. Imagine having air bottled. Then why do they bottle water? You know, the water in the taps is usually just as good as the water you get in bottles. And those bottles, those plastic bottles, they destroy the environment anyway. And you know, one of the most famous, I'll get into trouble again, maybe get sued, the Buddhist Society might get sued, but here we go, I've got no money anyway, so I don't have to pay. But one of the most common of the drinking waters in bottles, Evian water. You know Evian water? And what does that spell backwards? Naive, yes. So I call it naive water. It is, it spells naive backwards. You've got water in the tap for free. Why do you have to buy that thing for? If you want to get it, get a little filter if you want to sort of take out some of the impurities or whatever in it. But why do you have to buy this stuff? This is like buying wisdom. As if like somebody owns it. Like only the Theravada forest tradition, disciples of Ajahn Brahm who live in Australia have wisdom. Other traditions don't. Isn't that crazy? But only the Mahayana have the real truth. Only the Tibetans have the deeper truth. Only the... Oh, come on, guys. Girls. Can't we share wisdom, compassion, truth? Can't we actually come together like the story of the seven blind men and the kangaroo and join our wisdom together? If we can do that, maybe you, husbands and wives, instead of arguing, compare notes, combine your views, and get a far, far better understanding of life than either of you can get by yourself. Then it's not only just overcoming arguments, it's overcoming wars. Wars between ideologies, wars between political systems, wars between financial systems. Can't we just combine? Not saying I am the best and you're inferior. The ability, the ego of religions, like the ego of people, always having to be right. The best, the chief, that is a problem. Just like a woman, a man always think, I have to be the best, therefore I have to be right. The ego, which is in political parties and religions, just as it is with human beings. So we can overcome that, we can have a peaceful and happy world, and I'll be out of a job. And I'll be very happy to be out of a job. Thank you for listening. Okay, look, I've been away for a while. If you're going to clap, clap! That's much better. Very good. One of Ajahn Chah's pieces of advice. Whatever you do, give it everything you've got. Okay? Whatever you do, give it everything you've got. If you give a donation on your way out, give it anything you can. Your whole bank account. No, come on. Okay, questions. Very good. Here we go. From the USA and from India. First of all, from first USA. I have a dear friend who has been scarred in life and is always resentful. In recent days, she has deliberately pressed my buttons during a traumatic time for me. It has opened some old wounds, I'm losing my will to live. How can I embrace the hurt of the past and open the door of my heart to my friend's abrasive personality? Look, many people have been scarred in life, and they somehow want to stigmatize their emotional scars and reject them. Please remember the story I told about the last time I was here, the tree in the forest. If you can find a tree in the forest which hasn't been scarred, which isn't bent all over and crooked, which hasn't got branches ripped off by the storms of life, you'll be the first person to find a tree like that. Every tree in the forest in nature is always damaged by life. And in fact, the trees which are the most crooked and bent, which have the most scars on their trunks, they're the most beautiful. They're the ones I like, and I'm sure you like. So please don't look at the scars and wounds of life as something which is detracting, you know, from your happiness and from your beauty. Change one's attitude and you see those traumas of your life as something which, number one, means you belong to the forest called humanity. And in fact, that you belong as one of the more beautiful trees in the forest called humanity. We've all got our scars, some more than others. Some you can see, some you can't. But they actually make us beautiful once we embrace them and allow them in. And so please, share these stories with your friend. And if they're pressing your buttons during a traumatic time for me, look, the only reason why you have buttons, you know, is you just allow other people to control your happiness. Sometimes you do need time out to get greater resilience and strength. When you get greater resilience and strength, your buttons aren't so easy to press. One of the reasons why people do go on retreats, they do go into monasteries, they do go off into the wilderness by themselves for a while, is because in that calm quietness of solitude that you get inner strength. When you're in the forest, you can't see your way. When you're above, beyond the forest, like Google Views, you can understand where you are and how it all works. In that simile of the pyramid in the forest I said a few weeks ago. So when you can get that pyramid in the forest and climb that pyramid and see the full picture, then your buttons aren't pressed anymore. You understand what's going on in life. You're not so confused. So first of all, take time out. Take time out, first of all, until your buttons get just so desensitized. Not in a bad way, but in a good way, that you can actually be resilient. And then you can be a true friend to the other person who's causing you problems in life. At the moment, you're too weak to help anybody. So please, take time out, first of all, by yourself. Get strong again, and then you'll be able to help others. Even as a monk, me, I have to spend a lot of time by myself to get my energies back up again. I go on retreats. I do meditate a lot. Because otherwise, you know, after a while, you just get tired. And I can't serve anybody. So it's important to look after yourself so you can look after others. The next one from the United States, Johnny from the United States, that was Yuka from the United States. Since making mistakes can be valuable, shouldn't one not follow the Eightfold Path so they can make more? That is the Eightfold Path, making mistakes. So we learn from making mistakes. So the first factor of the Eightfold Path is right view. So don't try and be a perfect Buddhist. If you try to be a perfect Buddhist, you'll get so stressed out, you'll be a pain in the ass for all the monks and nuns who have to teach you. So just let go of perfection. Let go of the idea of judging. Find some peace in your life. Be kind, which is part of non-judging. And then when you get peaceful and kind, you get so still, so happy, so wise. From compassion comes stillness, from stillness comes wisdom. From wisdom, you can make mistakes. It doesn't really matter. That is the Eightfold Path. Anyway, smart ass question. Hopefully I gave a smart ass answer. And from India, at times people's arguments appear to be childish rather than clear thought processes. Does that also reflect the ego? Is that the way it is? There are childish arguments, but even they're even, I think, less dangerous than intelligent arguments. Intelligent people have caused so much problems in our world. Please, I'm sorry, but that's true. The great thinkers have caused great wars. And so instead of actually clear thought processes which are clear of thought, not clear thinking, but clear of thought, peace, stillness, that is where wisdom comes from. Great thinkers have great assumptions, and they come to great conclusions, which are totally based on their assumptions, which are not true. And so we need to find a way of having calm, peace, stillness. And then we see things as they truly are. That is exactly how the Buddha says, Samadhi Paccayata Buddha Yana Dasana. From stillness, you see things as they truly are. And then, when we see things as they truly are, then we don't have arguments. Does that reflect the ego? Yeah, your thoughts build up the ego. You think who you are, you think just how great you are. Have you ever noticed fantasies? Someone told me this. They were on a meditation retreat. They're having all these fantasies. And they told me, in each of their fantasies, they were always the hero. They never lost in their fantasies. They always got the girl or the boy. They always scored the winning goal in the grand final. They always won the lottery. They never lost in their fantasies and dreams. You're always the winner in your thoughts. Just like your arguments. Can you see what's happening? We want to win. We want to be the hero. You don't have to be the hero. In fact, being hero sucks. You look at the hero movies. They're always in trouble. They can never rest and relax. You know, the hero movies? I think I said this last time. I was actually a friend of Steven Spielberg's some years ago. I think I met them in Singapore. And I put this idea to them. You know, Steven Spielberg, the great director in DreamWorks. Now they've done Iron Man. They've done Rusty Man. Have done Rusty Man yet? they've done Spider-Man. What else have they done? Batman. Superman. Who else they've done? Oh, these are all comics I used to read as a kid. But the one they haven't done yet, the one which is going to change the whole of Hollywood, the franchise of the future of our modern age, Super Monk. And you can see the spin-offs of, after Super Monk, that'd be episode one, then Super Nun. You have to have Super Nun. Then Super Novice, Little Novice. Then Super Layman, Super Laywoman, Super Meditator, whatever. Because I had the plot all figured out. It's obvious, you know, Super Monk. Obviously, you know, have these disasters like terrorist attacks, like, you know, like the Twin Towers terrorist attacks. Say, for example, Super Monk meditating would see there was a problem in his meditation. That there were terrorists had taken over a plane and they're going to fly into the Twin Towers. And what does Super Monk does? He levitates. And he levitates the speed of light, because levitate, you can get into the plane easy. He levitates and he finds those terrorists. And of course, he doesn't go fighting them. He just loses beautiful loving kindness. And say, you know, all this argument business of yours, terrorist, You know, it's just, we all are searching for God, for truth, for love, for respect, and I respect you. And just, you know, I forgive you. Just two bad bricks in the wall doesn't make a bad wall. Just, you know, just blowing up a few buildings doesn't make you a bad person. I forgive you. And that way, the terrorists get so amazed that they're forgiven and peaceful. And they say, oh, we realized that we made a mistake. We will never do any violent acts ever again. We will also be vegetarians. And we will and so I had all these beautiful endings to my fantasies. But anyway, it didn't pass muster. And I was told afterwards the reason why, because there was no violence and sex in Supermonk. Without violence and sex, you can't sell movies. So that was the end of my idea for the new franchise. Anyway, I don't know where I got into. What did I get into that for? Oh yeah. Anyway, I've already done the three sadhus, so enough. Get out of here. Come on. Good night, everyone. See you next week. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. So, any other questions? Any other questions from the floor? No. Good. Great. Let's pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, then go. Oh, we got another question. Okay. I have to do this. Oh. Anyone interested in participating in the World Assembly of Seven Buddhist Sages Meditation Camp in South Korea, all welcome. That's in the posters about the World Meditation Masters Camp. That's happening in Korea in July. So you can see it on the board there. Very good. Most welcome. Yes. Okay, let's pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha now.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivade Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami